Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of souls.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Good evening, everyone, and welcome back. We have a lot to cover in this second episode, so we're going to get right down to business. I'm not going to recap the last episode, as there was so much information packed in, so I encourage you to listen to this series in episode order, to ensure that you can easily understand what is being discussed and so that you don't miss any integral information. With that said, let's jump back in. This is The Case of the West Memphis 3, Part 2. The Blue Beacon Truck Wash and Transients. This is one of the strangest aspects of their investigation. The West Memphis police were competent enough to track down credit card receipts from the truck wash customers, since it was located right next to the murder scene. However, records obtained about the daily traffic at the Blue Beacon Truck Wash ended at 7:26 p.m. on May the 5th, with no other pages being copied by the police. I mean, you have to ask why, right? There were also some receipts clearly missing from the logs about daily traffic which were provided. The West Memphis police interviewed all of the employees in a large group before choosing to only interview the employees who had worked the afternoon shift individually. Employees who worked the shift during the evening hours were not followed up with for some unknown reason. It was only at trial that the prosecution would call the manager who worked at the truck wash that evening. He was mostly called by the state prosecution to claim that the Blue Beacon truck wash was well lit at night, even though there were photographs taken at the night time which shows the substantial lighting already entered into evidence. JivePuppy.com offers a very interesting answer to why this avenue was not investigated further. To make a long story short, shortly before the murders, the West Memphis Drug Task Force had gotten into a lot of trouble with the Arkansas State Police for appropriating confiscated guns, money, and drugs from vehicles. Many of the officers on the Drug Task Force also assisted in an unofficial manner with the investigation into the murders. The Blue Beacon truck wash at the nearby truck stop would have served as the perfect opportunity for the Drug Task Force to do a great amount of their work. Perhaps they feared that more investigation into the area would blow the lid off their corruption, since the contraband investigated by the Arkansas State Police in early 1993 would prove to be just the tip of the iceberg. I may as well add that the larger truck stop nearby was barely investigated at all either. Take from that what you will. Also, and by the way, before we drop tonight's episode, I added a map over on our Instagram account. The map is of the area that we discuss in these episodes. It may assist you all in gaining an insight into the logistics and the area that we are discussing. Noteworthy sightings. A number of suspicious people were reported in the days immediately following the murder. Two boys, whom one was implied to be L.G. Hollingsworth, an early suspect, and an unknown girl, were seen at the laundromat the night of the murder at around 10:30 p.m. An eyewitness known only as Boone stated on May the 20th that, quote, "They had mud and blood on their clothes. Dixie was related to one of them. Hollingsworth, I think," unquote. Who those people were besides L.G. Hollingsworth has never been confirmed. L.G. Hollingsworth later admitted to going to the laundromat at around 9 p.m, which was backed up by his grandmother Dixie Hufford, who worked there. There were numerous stories of white vans stalking children. The connection to the victims came in when multiple friends of Christopher Byers claimed that they were pursued by a white van the week before the murders. This was confirmed by Christopher Byers' older brother Ryan. This testimony was also backed up by some adults in the area, who reported seeing white vans in their neighbourhoods in the week surrounding the murders as well. Some of the eyewitnesses differed on specific details, with two agreeing on the amount of windows, but another alleging that there was a red stripe on the van and giving differing accounts of what the vans actually looked like. John Mark Byers reported seeing a black van up on the service road the night of May 5th. A different witness saw a blue van with a crazy man waving around a gun at the same location. In a statement given in October of 1993, the Byers family claimed that a man in a green car had been taking pictures of Christopher a few months prior to the murders. He had a black coat, black pants, and long black hair. There were several suspicious sightings near the Blue Beacon truck wash and adjoining Robin Hood Hills woods. John Mark Byers told the police department that a man he had never seen before helped him search the wooded area on May 5th. Is this strange to anyone else? A complete stranger assists you in looking for his child after he has gone missing, then turns up murdered, and the stranger is never seen again. Another odd sighting was a man that may have emerged from the bayou or river area either the night of May 5th at around 10:30 p.m. or the next morning. This person was said to be muddy and acting strange. This person was later identified as Timothy C., an early suspect, although later dismissed as a person of interest. There is also no reasoning in the documents to say why the witness wasn't sure if it was 10:30 at night or the following morning. A witness also told the police department that a transient had been living off and on in Robin Hood Hills woods, where some of the eyewitnesses had last seen the victims. No evidence of a person living in the woods was found, and the presence of a full-time person dwelling within the woods would have almost certainly turned up evidence, providing they had not removed all trace, of course. The Blue Beacon truck wash employees claimed in a group interview that around 10 p.m. they saw two young white males looking for their son in a small Toyota car. While they may have been referring to John Mark Byers, who was searching with his son at the time, Byers drove an entirely different kind of vehicle. There is a lot of speculation that Terry Hobbs drove a Toyota car at this time. It has never been verified, although in a news clip where Pam and Terry find out the fate of their son, Pam becomes hysterical and collapses. This is in front of a Toyota car, though again it is not confirmed if this is Terry's Toyota car. There was also a sighting of a heavy-set black male around the 76 truck stop nearby. The manager claimed to have heard a gunshot in the woods at around 8:30 p.m., which was backed up by some of Byers' friends who were searching in the area at that time. None of the children were shot, just as a reminder, and the manager was not asked about the gunshot at trial. Ryan Clark, John Mark Byers' elder stepson, and his friends, while searching, also heard something extremely interesting. Someone who may have been in the woods at around 9 p.m. that night. They described hearing five splashes, as well as a gunshot around this time. They added that they quickly ran off because they were frightened. The group was on the other side of the wooded area, near the entrance to Robin Hood Hills, and about a quarter of a mile from the crime scene. John Mark Byers also claimed to hear this gunshot while he was out searching, although he stated that he was confident that it was a car backfiring. He also stated that he had an extensive relationship with firearms, so that he can easily tell the difference between a car backfiring and that of a gunshot. Another interesting clue was not a sighting, but a phone call that occurred on May the 11th to the West Memphis police station. During the phone call, the caller taunted the police, saying, quote, "I'm the one that killed those kids, those three kids. What you gonna do?" Unquote. The audio is actually available online if you'd like to listen for it yourself. I suggest checking out YouTube. Tunnel vision. The defense team for both Jesse Miskelly and Damien Eccles both strongly argued that Damien had been the West Memphis Police Department's prime suspect from day one. Allegedly, when the police pulled the bodies from the water, an officer exclaimed, quote, "Looks like Damien's finally killed somebody," unquote. This comment has been repeated in many different stories, but the actual origins are a little unclear. It appears to come from juvenile police officer Steve Jones, who told others he thought Damien was responsible while at the crime scene. Jones was only at the crime scene for a short time. He had to leave due to feeling sick and at the sight of the dead bodies. So Jones would have to have made the comment about Damien Eccles before any information or any evidence or even any details about the murders would emerge. It's almost like Steve Jones had decided that Damien Eccles was the killer before he even knew that the children had been murdered. Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell claimed that Damien and Jason were suspects from the very beginning of the investigation after the three teens were arrested. Officer James Sudbury had this to say in his notes in May of 93. Quote, "On the day after the bodies of the three boys were found, I had a conversation with Steve Jones, a juvenile officer for Crittenden County, Arkansas. In our conversation, I found that Steve and I shared the same opinion that the murders appeared to have overtones of occult sacrifice. During our conversation, Steve mentioned that all of the people known by him to be involved in cult-type activities, one person in particular stood out in his mind, that, in his opinion, was capable of being involved in this type of crime. That person was Damien Eccles." Unquote. FYI, there was no evidence to implicate Damien Eccles at this time. No physical evidence whatsoever that the crimes were committed as part of a satanic cult ritual or sacrifice. Although, let it be said, the crimes occurred at a time where the nationwide satanic panic was in full effect. The day after the bodies were found, May 7th, police officers James Sudbury and Steve Jones decided to pay Damien Eccles a visit at his home, located at 2706 South Grove and Broadway Trailer Park in West Memphis, Arkansas. When Jones and Sudbury arrived, Pamela and Eddie Hutchison, Damien's parents, were home. They had no objection to the officers speaking to Damien, and they spoke to him in his bedroom. Officer Sudbury commented later that when they entered Damien's room, they took a Polaroid photograph of Damien with his permission. They were startled and intrigued by two tattoos that he had, which Sudbury and Jones both observed, according to their statements. One tattoo was a satanic five-star pentagram on Damien's chest, and the other was a satanic symbol on his upper left arm slash shoulder, though this symbol was unknown to the officers. It has to be reiterated here that at this point there was no cause of death, there was no time of death or clear understanding of the children's deaths. It hadn't even been announced that they were in fact murdered at this stage. No evidence had been found at the crime scene, and it was in its early stages of being examined, so there was absolutely no reason to be at Damien Eccles' house questioning him. Either officers Sudbury and Jones had correctly guessed Damien's involvement in the crime from a town of more than 30,000 people, or Damien was being targeted for some other reason. Something which is intriguing with Sudbury and Jones' statements is that the week after the officers had spoken to Damien, his mother had taken a photograph of topless Damien working in his backyard. The photograph is available online. It's interesting because it shows that Damien had no tattoos. So when did the officers state that Damien had satanic tattoos? Well, it was a week before the supposed no tattoo photograph. Jerry Driver, the juvenile parole officer and senior to Steve Jones, said in an interview with the authors of Blood and the Innocents in 2006 that he could not get the West Memphis Police Department to be interested in Eccles as a suspect initially, at least not for the first few days of the investigation. He was told that he needed, quote, something to go on to lead to the suspicion, unquote. He said that they thought, quote, here's the juvenile officer foaming at the mouth yet again, unquote. For their part, the police department mostly maintained at the trial that Damien had simply been one of many suspects from the beginning of the case, but towards the end of May, he appeared to have moved up the list. Sergeant Mike Allen would say that by the time of Jesse's questioning on June the 3rd, Damien had been in the top three of their suspect pool. I reiterate, up until June the 3rd, there was no physical evidence against Damien Eccles at all. Then, Vicky Hutchison came forward and made a statement. She alleged that she attended a satanic cult meeting with Damien Eccles and gave the West Memphis police a few pieces of incriminating information about him. Damien Eccles was interviewed three times after the murders, once on May 7th by officers Jones and Sudbury, which I just mentioned. He was interviewed again together with his girlfriend, Dominie, and Jason Baldwin on May 9th, and then formally for a third time with an accompanying polygraph test on May 10th. Damien, it's worth mentioning, did not pass the polygraph. Damien continued to deny any and all involvement of the murders throughout each of his interviews and throughout the polygraph. The prosecution claimed during the trial that Damien was an adult who had waived his rights. They pointed out that his lawyer had arrived at the police station at 6:20 p.m. on May 10th, after the police department was done interviewing with Damien. Damien's mother, Pamela, would later claim at trial that Everett, Damien's attorney at the time, actually arrived at 5 p.m., and Damien would claim that he asked for a lawyer three times while being questioned, though he seemed to have a hard time remembering when exactly he communicated that to the officer questioning him. Ultimately, the judge ruled that Damien's rights were not substantially violated. The West Memphis Police Department did not tape any of the interviews with Damien, which led to a major point of contention between the defense and prosecution at trial. Damien claimed that the officers put words in his mouth and asked leading questions, guiding him into a corner with his answers. Whilst we cannot prove or disprove that happened, we can prove that the police did just that in their tactics with Jesse Miskelly during his interviews. We'll talk more about that in a short while. Damien did also admit to saying certain incriminating things in his interviews. He did claim that the boys were chosen by the killer because they would be easy to control. Though again, since it was not taped, we'll never actually know the substance of what went down or what was said exactly. There are a lot of comments attributed to Damien in his interviews which he strongly denies, but which the police state that he absolutely did say. Like I said, we will never know for sure. We also can't be sure of the exact times that Damien was interviewed for the third time that day. Damien alleged that it was over 8 hours and he was not given anything to eat or drink. Damien appeared on the top of two lists of cult members that were handed over to the West Memphis police. Many of the teenagers named on the list would be interviewed by police early in May. Damien's mother Pamela was also interviewed on May 12th. None of the other teens interviewed had parents that would be asked to come in, though the police would say later that Damien was the only one who gave truly incriminating answers in his interviews, and thus calling for the officers to want to speak with his mother. The police didn't elaborate on what those answers were, though. Damien was also featured on multiple witness questionnaires, which were forwarded to the state's crime lab towards the end of May. In the section where suspects were listed, his name often came up. It should be noted that each time this happened, other people's names were also on there too. Different suspects' names would also continue to be on reports forwarded to the state crime lab even after the arrest of Eccles. The second most popular suspects implicated by eyewitness statements appeared to be alleged drug dealers David W. and Frankie K., with L.G. Hollingsworth, Jason Howard Baldwin, and another teen named Robert B. also being included. I certainly think the investigation wasn't thorough enough, but they went through a long list of suspects in addition to Damien too. The West Memphis police also had a hell of a lot of witnesses telling them stories about Damien, which means that all the attention probably wasn't unwarranted at the time. At trial, the prosecution would claim that all the roads in the investigation led back to Damien. There is argument for them not being exactly wrong, it's just hard to see the extent that the police department was guiding those roads to lead there themselves. It's definitely a little odd to see so many of the suspects being teenagers rather than focusing on adults or those who actually knew the children. The West Memphis Police Department appeared to be more thorough in looking at alternative suspects early on in the investigation, but alas, after Damien's arrest, it appears that they dropped several leads completely. That'll be explained later when I talk about alternative suspects and alternative theories with evidence to support. So who was Damien Eccles? The oh-so-enigmatic figure of Damien Eccles. 18 years old at the time of the murders, he became the key suspect early on in the investigation. He was a high school dropout with an education level equal to that of a 14-year-old. He was arrested subsequent to Jesse Miskelly's confession, which implicated him as the murderer of the three young boys. He was always dressed in black and sometimes sporting provocative self-drawn tattoos, and with painted black and sharpened fingernails, Damien Eccles was into heavy metal music and nihilistic poetry. After the case became notorious, he developed a cult following of sorts and was romanticized as a loner, outsider, and a victim of a small town's demonization of the goth subculture. Damien's appearance, and what some would consider to be strange behavior, represented to many conservatives and religious folk in the community as being the ways of the devil. He openly displayed an interest in the occult and Wicca, and he listened to heavy metal music like Metallica, Slayer, and Pantera. It was the early 90s, and to many conservatives, heavy metal music still had connotations towards Satanism in their view. Those beliefs were not unique to West Memphis at this time. Gallup and Harris polls taken recently still show that 6 in 10 American adults believe in the existence of Satan, and 4 in 10 believe in the existence of demonic possession. Damien enjoyed playing to these fears. He enjoyed making people feel uncomfortable around him and created an image of what he would later say was, quote, the local boogeyman, unquote. In all of the police's door-to-door questioning, when officers asked the locals if they had witnessed anyone strange or suspicious looking, or if they had seen anyone who was not from their area or possible transient, not one person spoke about Damien Eccles. Those close to Damien, and there weren't many, knew that he had a history of mental illness and had spent time hospitalized for such conditions. Parole officer Jerry Driver was convinced that Damien was part of a satanic group, even though Damien repeatedly stated that he followed the Wiccan faith, a pacifist nature-based religion, although this might have been misconstrued as something satanic by Driver. Many people in the local area also believed that Damien had chosen his name after the Antichrist character in the Omen movies. He was born Michael Wayne Hutchison. He actually changed his name to Damien Wayne Eccles in his early teens after being adopted by his stepfather, Jack Eccles, who was a strict Catholic. At trial, he stated that he chose Damien because he had briefly explored Catholicism as a faith, and he was fascinated by Saint Damien, a controversial saint during his time who had worked with lepers and eventually contracted the disease himself. Jerry Driver, Damien's parole officer, sniffed at Damien's comments and stated at the time that Damien's only interest in the Catholic Church was to infiltrate it in order to steal the Eucharist for satanic ceremonies. Driver also went on to say that Eccles, Jesse Miskelly, Jason Baldwin, and Dominie Tia, Damien's girlfriend, had all always denied being involved in Satanism. Driver didn't believe them, however, stating that's what a Satanist would say. He would also make elaborate claims about Damien, though never presented anything to support his charges and claims. Probably the most extravagant claim by Driver was that Eccles and his girlfriend had planned to have a baby and sacrifice the child to the devil. Driver claimed he was told this would happen by a confidential informant, would remain unnamed. The perpetrator. Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell was the lead investigator in the case. His profile of the killer, which was published in the local newspaper soon after the murder, included an age range of late teens to early 20s. They would have a menial job, and they were probably a local man who was familiar with the area. Gitchell also said that this was the offender's first offence of this nature, and that the offender probably had contacted the police already. FBI criminal profiler John Douglas gave the following criminal profile of the killer. Douglas's profile would differ from Gitchell's. Douglas believed the perpetrator was likely an adult between 25 to 45 with a violent history. He was a male. They were organized, methodical, and likely very familiar with the victims. The purpose of the murder was initially to punish the victims, and that the perpetrator eventually went too far. The offender acted alone, and the murders occurred at the crime scene. The individual is an experienced huntsman or works in a related trade. He is experienced with firearms. Now, yes, there are suspects and even those convicted in the case that fit one or both of those profiles, but I won't link which to which. I'll let you do the math in this case. The other, Jason Baldwin. I mentioned earlier that there were two individuals in this case, both named Jason Baldwin, as if it wasn't confusing enough, right? Well, it just so happens that both Jason Baldwins were considered suspects in this case too. Both were completely unrelated and yet lived in the same area. One was Charles Jason Baldwin, the now infamous third of the West Memphis Three, the youngest of the three to be convicted. The other was named Jason Howard Baldwin, a larger teenager in stature with a much longer rap sheet and criminal history. Independent researchers into the case have since claimed that it's possible that Jesse, Damien, and Jason Howard were the ones who perpetrated the murders. This is backed up by Miss Kelly, who described Jason as the most violent of the three, and another witness claiming that Jason Baldwin was part of a cult. But I have some problems with this theory, though. Number one, Damien and Charles Jason Baldwin were best friends, while Damien had no such connection to Jason Howard Baldwin. Two, if Jesse Miss Kelly was telling the truth, there's the big question of why he never bothered to clarify which Jason he was talking about and why the police never bothered to run it by him to make sure. It's very loose speculation and comedic to think that it has just been overlooked for 30 years. So who was Charles Jason Baldwin? Charles Jason Baldwin was 16 years old at the time of his arrest, although he looked a year or two younger. Baldwin had previous run-ins with the police. He'd been arrested for vandalism alongside Eccles when they broke into a garage and damaged some cars. He was also arrested for shoplifting $6 worth of candy. Despite this, Baldwin was quiet and very shy around people. He earned good grades in high school and demonstrated a talent for drawing and art. He was encouraged by his teachers to study graphic design in college. Baldwin was best friends with Damien Eccles, and they shared the same taste in music and books. They were both outsiders and had a similar distaste for the common cultural zeitgeist in West Memphis. Baldwin loved Metallica and was often seen sporting Metallica t-shirts, broadcasting his love for the band. When Baldwin wasn't out with Eccles, he enjoyed playing video games at home with his brother. He had no history of alcohol use, drug use, or mental illness, although he was said to suffer from low self-esteem. Interestingly, after his trial, the jury listed Baldwin's low self-esteem as one of the reasons why they convicted him, whatever that means. By all intent purposes, he was just a normal, quiet teenager from a dirt-poor background. Who was Jesse Lloyd Miss Kelly Jr.? Miss Kelly was born on the 10th of July 1975. He, like the other two suspects, Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin, was from an impoverished background and lived in a trailer park in West Memphis. Like Eccles, he was a high school dropout, and he was measured to have an IQ of just 72, which meant that he had significant learning difficulties. His family would say that Jesse was a sensitive boy and was extremely close to his stepmother and father, Jess Miss Kelly Sr. At the time of the murders, Jesse led a simple existence, where he worked a manual job at a roofing company, had a girlfriend, and enjoyed heavy metal music and amateur wrestling. Jesse knew Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin from school, but the boys were not close or friends. They didn't socialize, and as Jesse and Damien had both dropped out of school, Jesse had not had any interaction with Jason or Damien for a number of months prior to their arrest for the murders of Stevie Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. Jesse Miss Kelly's confessions. Okay, so, when you analyze all the confessions, a common structure begins to emerge. The general narrative provided by Miss Kelly is thus. Jesse, Damien and Jason go to the woods. Damien calls or lures the boys over to them and starts attacking one, with Jason quickly joining in. Jesse then grabs Michael Moore, who tries to run away. Jason is responsible for the most brutal knife attacks, and the boys are thrown in the water and Jesse leaves the scene early. It is some sort of sexual element that is generally referred to, though it changes from oral and anal rape to more vague roughing up over time. Most of Miss Kelly's statements, except for the first one, make reference to the three teenagers hiding in the woods and waiting for the children to attack. A so-called crime of opportunity, if you will. Pretty much all of the statements make some sort of reference to a satanic cult that the three of the teenagers are supposedly members of. Confession 1. On June 3rd, 1993, Jessie Miss Kelly was picked up for questioning by the West Memphis Police Department. The police would later claim it was to receive more information about Damien Eccles from Miss Kelly. I'll make it clear now that whilst Damien Eccles and Jessie Miss Kelly knew each other, they weren't close friends, they were in the same grade in high school and were on friendly terms, but they didn't hang out together, and both boys had dropped out of high school a while before the murders had occurred. West Memphis police had become aware of Jesse's supposed connection to Damien. This awareness came from a testimony from eyewitness Vicky Hutchison, who said that she attended a cult meeting with both Damien and Jesse. I mentioned this previously. It was the only evidence that the police had against Damien Eccles, that someone said they attended a cult meeting with him. Cult meetings weren't and still aren't illegal in West Memphis, Arkansas, or the United States as a whole. I digress. Jesse was picked up by the police and taken to the police station at roughly 9:45 a.m. At 10 a.m, Jesse's interview started. He was just sharing information about a supposed friend, remember? At 11:30 a.m, Jesse was hooked up to and administered a polygraph test. Jesse also had other conversations with the police afterwards at 12:30 p.m. about his involvement with a supposed cult. At 2:44 p.m, Jesse made the first confession on tape. I encourage anyone interested in this case to read this confession in its entirety. The link to it is www.callahan.mysite.com/wm3/jmjune1.html. It gives you a true picture of the discussion the police had with Jesse. It's roughly a 40-minute read. The basic framework of the confession is that Jason Baldwin asked Jesse Miss Kelly to go to West Memphis with him and Damien the night before the murders. They left at 9 o'clock in the morning, and in an uncertain time frame to Jesse, they hit, raped, and murdered the three children when they came across them. Jesse stated that he left while Jason and Damien were, quote, screwing the boys, unquote. Then the victims were put in the water. The murder weapon used was a 6-inch long folding knife, Jesse said. He also mentioned being part of a satanic cult with Jason and Damien for the last 3 months, where they killed dogs and had orgies with girls. Jesse claimed that Damien had been watching the victims for a long time. Jesse did not take a polygraph test after giving his confession, and he did not go to the crime scene to corroborate it, despite the police officers planning to do so. Jesse was asked a total of 340 questions in this confession. 12 were open-ended, and 211 were targeted yes or no questions. Jesse answered no to 38 of them. Jesse Miss Kelly had an IQ of 72, which meant he was considered to have an intellectual disability. He was also 17 at the time of questioning by police, making him a minor, and he did not have any parent or guardian present during his questioning, nor any attorney. Miss Kelly had a reputation for being hot-tempered and regularly engaged in fistfights. He too came from a family that lived in extreme poverty at the time. Analyzing this confession. Before we start talking about the info that Jesse was correct about, we also need to talk about the info that he got completely wrong. The detectives took the time to describe much of the crime scene to him on more than one occasion. Whilst his polygraph and the following interview with him was recorded, the interview that the police conducted with Jesse initially over several hours when he turned up at the police station was not recorded, and we don't know what the police said to Jesse here. Okay, so there's a few things to unpack here. Firstly, Jesse initially says that he held Michael Moore down at the service road before the others caught up to him, placing the crime scene there, around a quarter of a mile away from the actual crime scene. Ridge then redirects the conversation back to when Damien apparently hit Michael prior to him running, and suddenly the crime scene changes again. All mention of the crime scene happening at the service road is then abandoned. Note, Jesse was unable to correctly name where the crime scene took place out of the multiple options in the first instance. He says that Damien and Jason orally and anally raped the victims numerous times. But, and this is a pretty big but, there was no evidence and nothing conclusive to suggest that any of the boys had been raped either orally or anally. The medical examiner would testify at trial that since no semen was found in the oral or anal cavities, and there was no traumatic injuries to the anus, most modern experts would agree that sexual assault and penetration likely did not happen. Jesse also claims that one boy was cut in the bottom and is then led by Chief Inspector Gary Gitchell to say the groin area. Jesse just agrees. Note that Jesse had told the police interviewers that Damien and Jason had beat the boys with their clothes on, despite no blood being found on the clothes. But let's look further. So there's a lot that was wrong with Jesse's first confession. There are far more points than I have listed thus far, which is why I encourage you to read the confession interview in full to gain your full independent thoughts. Once again, the link to the interview transcript is www.callahan.mysite.com/w3/jmjune1.html. Issues with criminal confessions are not necessarily unheard of in criminal history, even among people who are very guilty. The police may have had to press Jesse to admit to more information. There are also some interesting moments that hint perhaps the confession was not as coerced and innocent as commonly suggested. Jesse's legal rights were covered extensively. Despite Jesse's Miranda rights not being signed by his dad did allow him to take a polygraph and was agreeable to Jesse being questioned. Jesse was informed of his rights multiple times. Jesse did have experience with the police and signing legal right waivers before this time. It's also worth noting that some of the leading questions asked of Jesse may have been to retread certain points that Jesse said before the tape confession began. We have to look at the lack of recording of the first taped meeting from both sides to ensure fairness. There are examples of Jesse attempting to minimize his involvement in the crime and also tripping up to reveal more details too. Jesse also may have slipped up and shown some knowledge of the crime itself. There are three elements brought up here by Jesse. Number one, that he knew about Stevie's injuries on his face. Number two, that he knew Michael's body was found in a different location than the other two boys. And number three, that he knew about Christopher's castration. But again, we don't know what the police said to Jesse in the hours prior to when the interviews were recorded. It works both ways. Also, this confession from Jesse occurred around a month after the crime had taken place. Various details about the crimes had leaked into the community in this time. We know this, and many witnesses throughout the month of May, when questioned about the crimes, shared information about the crimes that they knew. So the West Memphis police were not as secretive as they thought they were. John Mark Byers said his son was castrated on May the 19th, for example. Jesse initially says bottom anyways, and he is clearly led to saying groin and penis by Gary Gitchell. It's unclear if Jesse is signifying a different murder scene for Moore, since he only mentions bringing Moore back to the crime scene. This could be interpreted as Jesse saying he brought Moore to the same place as Chris and Stevie, or that he brought Moore back to the general vicinity of the scene, but a little bit apart, as the body was found. The police interviewer should have asked for clarity, but didn't. Some investigators, including the police at the time, will say that Jesse is the first person to bring up the murders happened at night. But to be fair, in the same sentence, Jesse also mentions that he went home at around noon after the murders. So personally, I take this factoid with a pinch of salt. Jesse's attempt to minimize his role throughout the entire confession and casts Damien and Jason as the truly evil ones who carried out the murders, while himself was essentially an observer through most of it. He claims throughout the confession that he never engaged in any of the violence against the boys and frequently tries to assert that he left the scene. In later confessions, and even when claiming his innocence to psychologists, he would note that he had helped beat one of the boys up and helped tie them. In an extract of his interview with sociologist Richard Offshey in December 1993, Jesse claimed that his confessions were entirely coerced. He also commented in the same interview that he held one boy and beat him up really bad, yet in all of Jesse's confessions prior to December 1993, he denied that he helped to hurt any of the boys. Confession number two. This was a second statement made by Jesse on the same day as the previous one. The time frame is unclear, however. The officers testified at trial that it happened at around 5 p.m., but there was no hard clarification of this. It contains even more details, such as more graphic details of Damien and Jason orally and anally raping the victims, and also contains new blatant misinformation, such as a brown rope used to tie the victims. The victims were tied with shoelaces, as we know. You can read the full second interview transcript by following the below link. It's similar to the first transcript linked, so be careful to enter it correctly. It's www.callahan.mysite.com/wm3/jmjune2.html. My co-researcher on this series, Grace, raised a good point here. She said that the shoelaces may have been muddy and seemed like brown rope to Jesse. I thought that was worth mentioning. The most important aspect of this second confession is that the time of the murders was clarified on record, as you'll see here. Gitchell here states that earlier, Jesse had told him the murders occurred at 7 or 8, when in actual fact, Jesse had told him in the previous confession interview that the murders occurred at 12 p.m. and that the boys had skipped school. Well, we know that the boys hadn't skipped school that day. They were all there until 3 p.m. when it finished. But 7 or 8 p.m. is a hell of a time leap from originally saying that it happened at midday. The West Memphis Police Department alleged that they had not talked to Jesse in between the two confessions. Jesse wrote in a letter to his family sometime between the 4th and 6th of June, and that in the letter, Jesse strongly affirmed his innocence. But also in June, Jesse confessed to the murders again to his defense lawyer. By this point, I don't know about you, but I have no idea what the hell to believe from Jesse. But given his intellectual disability and erratically changing story, do you think his confessions are reliable ones? Ones to base an entire court case on? Confession 3. In August, Jesse confessed to his defense lawyer. He reaffirmed some of the details of his earlier confessions. But he also now claimed that there was no stick used as a murder weapon where he previously said that there was. But he now said that he just saw Damien carrying a stick around with him a lot prior to the murders. He mentioned beer cans and the teens drinking in this interview, which he hadn't mentioned before. He also said that the boys' clothing was piled up next to the creek, a change from his previous confession, where he stated that the clothes were just dumped in the water. Jesse stated that he was volunteering the information and that he was not seeking reward money. At the end of the session, his attorney said that he thought Jesse should plead guilty and testify against the other two teenagers, Eccles and Baldwin, in exchange for a reduced sentence. In 2009, His lawyer said in Jesse Miskelley's Rule 37 hearing that Jesse continued to confess to his lawyers both through the months leading up to his trial and after, because he didn't know what a defense attorney was, and he thought that they were the police and that's what they wanted to hear. After Jason's sentence, he also told his attorney that he didn't know why he had been sent to jail. Jesse Miskelley's December interview. This interview is the one where Jesse first pleads his innocence on record to his defense lawyers, along with a psychologist that would testify to Jesse's IQ at trial. This interview is worth reading and is very revealing to Jesse's mindset and understanding of things at the time. The link transcript is www.callahan.mysite.com/wm3/jm_wilkins_stidham.html. Now, this interview isn't very easy to decipher, but stick with it if you can. Jesse frequently mixes up times and facts and often circles around unimportant questions while ignoring crucial ones. Jesse's timeline is that his dad told him the police were going to be questioning him about a tip that he had given. His dad had wanted the reward money and was eager for Jesse to talk to the West Memphis police to obtain it. Jesse arrived at the police station, had an interview, took the polygraph test and failed. Jesse said that the police asked him the same question on the polygraph three separate times. It did take a rather long time for him to complete the test, though the officers claimed at trial that he had spent a good chunk of the polygraph time going over Jesse's rights with him and explaining what the test was. Jesse was then told by police that he was lying in the polygraph and that the officers had seen him at a cult meeting with Damien Eccles in Terrell, a small town about 20 miles north of West Memphis. Jesse said that the police began to holler at him. He was also played a short recording of one of the murdered boy's friends giving a witness statement. While Jesse began describing the cult that he, Damien and Jason supposedly belonged to, without confessing to the murders, Jesse said that the police also drew a circle where Jesse claimed that they put himself, Damien and Jason inside, while asking Jesse if he wanted to join the police on the outside. Gary Gitchell admitted that he had drawn some sort of diagram, though he would demur on the particulars and say he had not specified any of the three defendants by name. The final straw was when he was shown a picture of Christopher Byers' face post-mortem. Jesse then said that he wanted to get out and began to confess to the murders to wind things up, prompted by the police, who Jesse said, soon walked him through what to say. According to Jesse, he was frequently corrected on answering questions before the tape recorder was even turned on. He said that they only rehearsed what he had to say once, but that he had to go over certain parts again and again to get it right before he gave his confession on tape. He did not make it clear in his interview whether he received the same coaching before his second statement or not. In a different interview, Jesse claimed that the officers would shake their heads no when Jesse got parts of his confession wrong on tape, as to not have them guiding him recorded. Jesse told his defense lawyer that the West Memphis police did not give him anything to eat or let him go to the bathroom for his entire time at the police station. There is no evidence that the police physically assaulted him in any way, and the officer's log said that Jesse was offered food after his first confession at 3:22 p.m., but that Jesse refused to eat. At some point, Jesse alleged that the policeman lied to him by telling him that Damien and Jason had sex with each other, though they did not tell him that Damien and Jason had sex with the other boys. Jesse appears to have made that connection up on his own. Jesse also claimed that he lied about killing a dog in the cult and was not pressed to say it by the police. He said that he didn't know what a cult was and automatically associated it with devil worship, so he made up all the details about what he thought devil worshippers would do to the police. The police did apparently tell Jesse about a briefcase that the cult owned. You see, an earlier eyewitness, Aaron Hutchison, had detailed a cult meeting in Robin Hood Hills where a briefcase appeared to the West Memphis police. And finally, when affirming his innocence, Jesse's alibi for May 5th was considerably different from the one given at trial. He said he went to work until 5 p.m, something that his employer denied and disproved at trial, when he said he left Jesse off at around lunchtime that day. Interview with Dr. Richard Offshee. On December the 15th, 1993, at the Clay County Detention Center, Jesse Miskelly was interviewed by Dr. Richard Offshee. During the interview, and as I previously stated, Jesse said he was at work until about 5 p.m. on May the 5th, something that he told the police officers. This time he also mentioned his activities in the Highland Trailer Park, an important part of his alibi that would be elaborated on 2 months later at trial. Jesse Miskelly's alibi at trial was that Jesse was at a wrestling event with friends in a nearby town on the night of the murders. Jesse said that after getting off from work, he saw a cop car disturbance at 6:30 p.m. and then met the numerous friends who would become witnesses and testify later in his defense. Jesse told Dr. Offshee that the reason he shared with the police that the murders were committed in the morning was that he didn't want to conflict with his alibi of working until dinner time, despite that alibi being proven to be untrue. Jesse claimed that Gary Gitchell told him the boys were tied up with shoestrings, despite stating that they were tied up with brown rope. It takes quite some time for Jesse to clarify that Gitchell told him this on the day after the confessions. Jesse also said that he knew the boys had been cut in the penis area because his friend in Search and Rescue had told him so. Jesse actually did have a friend in Search and Rescue, and he would testify that at trial. Interestingly, Jesse claimed that he decided to come up with Damien and Jason's involvement in the murders and the cult on his own, instead of being coerced by the police. Jesse had initially implicated Damien and Robert Birch to the police before taking the polygraph, but had changed his mind afterwards because Jason was the one who was always carrying knives around, he thought. When pressed further why he didn't just name Robert Birch, Jesse couldn't really give Dr. Offshee an answer. There are numerous other details that Jesse confirmed that he had made up instead of the police coercing him. Examples were details of specific cult activities which Jesse said just popped into his head, and also that Damien and Jason were having sex with the boys. Jesse also lied about statements he made on record. He said that he never mentioned there being cocaine in the cult briefcase, or that Damien watched little boys at the skating rink, despite both comments being made by Jesse on tape. Now, I've discussed a lot of things that Jesse has covered in his numerous confessions and interviews tonight, and I think it's key that you guys all listening catch up. Use the links I've provided to get to the transcripts and familiarize yourselves with the information therein. This has been another long and detailed episode with a hell of a lot to digest, so I'm going to end this there tonight. We'll be back with part 3 next week, so keep an eye out for that one. Also, as a little bonus episode, midweek, I'm going to drop another special report episode that I've been working on recently. I'm spoiling you guys, I really am. Until then, good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.